We got away, sure, but someone pinned a hell of a lot of trouble on us in return.
"You know what I'd like to do when I'm in a foul mood?" said Esri sweetly. "I like to sack ships."
She raised her finger and pointed slowly across the deck, past the hustling crewfolk, out to sea, where another vessel could just be seen, lit by its stern lanterns against the southern darkness.
"Oh, look! There's one right now."
They were knocking on Drakasha's cabin door just moments later.
"You wouldn't be standing on two legs if that blood was yours," she said as she invited them in. "Is it too much to hope that it belongs to Stragos?"
"It is."
"Pity.
Well, at least you came back. That's reassuring." Paolo and Cosetta were tangled together on their little bed, snoring peacefully. Drakasha seemed to see no need to whisper in their presence. Locke grinned, remembering that he'd learned to sleep through some pretty awful distractions at their age, too.
"Did you make any real progress?" asked Drakasha.
"We bought time," said Locke, "and we got out of the city. The issue was in doubt."
"Captain," said Del Mastro, "we were sort of wondering if we could get started on the next part of this whole scheme a bit early. Like, right now?"
"You want to do some boarding and socializing?"
"There is a likely suitor waiting to dance about 2 miles south by west, away from the city, outside the reefs."
"And the city's a bit absorbed in the festa at the moment," added Locke.
"It'd just be a quick visit, like we've been discussing," said Esri. "Rouse them up, make them piss their britches, loot the purse and the portable goods, throw things overboard, cut some chains and cripple the rigging."
"I suppose we have to start somewhere," said Drakasha. "Del, send Utgard down to borrow some of my silks and cushions. I want a makeshift bed rigged for the children in the rope locker. If I'm going to wake them up to hide them, it's only fair."
"Right," said Del Mastro.
"What's the wind?"
"Out of the northeast."
"Put us around due south. Bring it onto the larboard quarter. Reefed topsails, slow and steady. Tell Oskal to hoist out the boats behind our hull so our friend can't see them in the water."
"Aye, Captain."
Del Mastro shrugged out of her overcoat, left it on Drakasha's table, and ran from the cabin. A few seconds later, Locke could hear commotion on deck, Oskal shouting about how they'd only just been told to raise the boat, and Del Mastro yelling something about soft-handed, slack-witted idlers.
"You two look ghastly," said Zamira. "I'll have to get a new sea-chest to separate the blood-drenched finery from the clean. Confine yourselves to wearing reds and browns next time."
"You know, Captain," said Locke, staring down at the blood-soaked sleeves of his jacket, "that sort of gives me an idea. A really, really amusing idea."
4. Just past the second hour of the morning, with Tal Varar finally shuddering into a drunken slumber and the festa fires extinguished, the poison orchid in her costume as the Chimera crept past the happy Pilchard. She passed the battered, sleepy little ketch at a distance of about 200 yards, flying a minimal number of navigational lanterns and offering no hail. That wasn't entirely unusual, in waters where not one act of piracy had been reported for more than 7 years. In darkness, it was impossible to see that the Orchid's deck carried no boats. Those boats slowly emerged from the ship's larboard shadow, and at a silent signal their rowers exploded into action. With the haste of their passage, they turned the dark sea white. 3 faint, frothy lines reached out from Orchid to Pilchard, and by the time the lone watchman on the ketch's stern noticed anything, it was far too late.
"Ravel!" cried Jean, who was the first up the ketch's side. "Ravel!"
Still dressed in his blood-spattered finery, he'd wrapped a scrap of red linen around his head and borrowed an iron-shod quarterstaff from one of the Orchid's arms lockers. Orchid scrambled up behind him, Jabril and Malakasti, Striva and Rask. They carried clubs and saps, leaving their blades sheathed at their belts. 3 boats' worth of pirates boarded from 3 separate directions.
The Ketch's meagre crew was swept into the waste by shouting, club-waving lunatics, all hollering a name that was meaningless to them, until at last they were subdued and the chief of their tormentors came aboard to exult in his victory.
"The name's Ravel!"
Locke paced the deck before the 13 cringing crewfolk and their strange blue-robed passenger. Locke, like Jean, had kept his bloody clothing and topped it off with a red sash at his waist, a red bandana over his hair, and a scattering of Zemira's jewellery for effect.
"Orin Ravel, and I've come back to pay my respects to Tal Verar."
"Don't kill us, sir," pleaded the captain of the little vessel, a skinny man of about 30 with the tan of a lifelong mariner. "We ain't even from Tal Verar, just calling so our charter can..."
"You are interrupting critical hydrographic experiments," shouted the blue-robed man, attempting to rise to his feet.
He was shoved back down by a squad of leering orchids.
"This information is vital to the interest of all mariners. You cut your own throat if you..."
"What the hell's a critical hydrographic experiment, old man?"
"By examining seafloor composition..."
"Seafloor composition? Can I eat that? Can I spend it? Can I take it back to my cabin and fuck it sideways?"
"No, and no, and most certainly no."
"Right," said Locke. "Toss this fucker over the side."
"You ignorant bastards! You hypocritical apes! Let go! Let go of me!"
Locke was pleased to see Jean stepping in to perform the duty of heaving the robed scholar off the deck. Not only would the man be scared witless, but Jean would control the situation precisely to keep him from actually getting hurt.
"Oh, please, sir, don't do that," said the Pilchard's captain. "Master Donati's harmless, sir, please."
"Look," said Locke, "is everyone on this tub an idiot besides me? Why would I sully the soles of my boots with a visit to this embarrassment unless you had something I wanted?"
"The, hydrographic experiments?" asked the captain.
"Money." Locke seized him by the front of his tunic and heaved him to his feet. "I want every valuable, every drinkable, every consumable this overgrown dinghy has to offer, or you can watch the old bastard drown. How's that for a hydrographic experiment?" 5. They didn't clear such a bad haul for such a little ship. Obviously, Donati had paid well to be carried around for his experiments, and been unwilling to sail without many of the comforts of home. A boat laden with liquors, fine tobacco, silk pillows, books, artificers' instruments, alchemical drugs, and bags of silver coins was soon sent back to the Orchid, while Ravel's pirates finished sabotaging the little ship.
"Rudder line's disabled, sir,"
said Jean about half an hour after they'd boarded.
"Halyards cut! Braces cut!"
shouted Del Mastro, plainly enjoying her role as an ordinary buccaneer for this attack. She strolled along the larboard rail with a hatchet, chopping things seemingly at whim.
"Whatever the hell that was, cut!"
"Sir, please," pleaded the captain. "That'll take ages to fix. You've got all the valuables already."
"I don't want you to die out here," said Locke, yawning in feigned boredom at the captain's pleas. "I just want to have a few quiet hours before this news gets back to Tal Verar."
"Oh, sir, we'll do what you ask. Whatever you want, we won't tell no one."
"Please," said Locke. "Cling to some dignity, Master Pilchard. I want you to talk about this all over the place. Use it to leverage sympathy from whores. Maybe get a few free drinks in taverns. Most importantly, repeat my name, Orin Ravel."
Orin Ravel, sir."
"Captain Orin Ravel," said Locke, drawing a dagger and placing it against the captain's throat. "Of the good ship Tal Verar is fucked. You stop in and let them know I'm in the neighbourhood."
I will, sir."
"Good." Locke dropped the man back to the deck and stowed his dagger. "Then let's call it quits. I'll let you have your amusing little toy ship back now.
Locke and Jean met briefly at the stern before boarding the last boat back to the Orchid.
Gods, said Jean, the Archon is going to love this.
Well, we didn't lie to him, did we? We promised pirate attacks at every compass point. We just didn't say they'd all feature Zamira as the major attraction.
Locke blew a kiss to the city, spread across the northern horizon. Happy Festa, Protector. 6.
If there's one thing I never particularly need to do again in my life, said Locke, it's dangle here all day painting this bloody ship's ass.
At the third hour of the afternoon the next day, Locke and Jean were hanging from crude rope swings secured to the Poison Orchid's taffrail. Now that last night's hasty coat of dark paint had forever blotted out the Chimera, they were laboriously christening the ship with a new moniker, Delight. Their hands and tunics were spattered with thick silver gobs. They had gotten as far as Delig, and Paolo and Cosetta were making faces at them through the stern windows of Zamira's cabin.
I think piracy's a bit like drinking, said Jean. You want to stay out all night doing it, you pay the price the next day.
The Orchid had turned north that morning, a comfortable 40 or 50 miles west of the city. Drakasha had cleared the area of their pilchard raid with haste, and decided to spend the day at a remove, brushing up her old wooden girl's new disguise, or, more accurately, turning that duty over to Locke and Jean. They finally managed to put the light into delight around the fourth hour of the afternoon. Thirsty and sunbaked, they were hauled up to the quarterdeck by Del Mastro, Drakasha, and Nazreen. After they'd gulped down proffered mugs of lukewarm cask water, Drakasha beckoned for them to follow her down to her cabin.
"Last night was well done," she said. "Well done and nicely confusing. I don't doubt the Archon will be rather vexed."
"I'd pay something to be a fly on a tavern wall in Tal Vahrar these next few days," said Locke.
"But it's also given me a thought on our general strategy."
"Which is?"
"You told me that captain and crew of the Ketch weren't Vahrari. That will curb some of the impact of their story. There'll be questions about their reliability, ignorant rumors and mutterings."
"Right.
So what we've just done will fester," said Zamira. "It will cause comment, speculation, and a great deal of aggravation to Stragos, but it won't cause a panic, or have the Vahrari rioting in the streets for his intercession. In a way, as our first bit of piracy on his behalf, it's a bit of a botched job."
"You wound our professional pride," said Jean.
"And my own. But consider this. Perhaps what we need is a string of similarly botched jobs."
"This sounds like it's going to have a very entertaining explanation," said Locke.
"Del told me this afternoon that you two are pinning your hopes for a solution on Stragos' personal alchemist, that you can somehow secure his assistance by making him a private offer."
"That's true enough," said Locke. "It's one of the aspects of last night's visit to the Mon Magisteria that didn't go very well."
"So obviously what we need to do," said Drakasha, "is give you another chance to make this alchemist's acquaintance, another plausible reason to visit the Mon Magisteria soon. Good little servants, eager to hear their master's opinion on how their work is progressing."
"Ah," said Locke. "And if he's looking to shout at us, we can be sure he'll at least let us in for a chat."
"Exactly. So, what we need to do is something colorful, something striking, something that is undeniably a sincere example of our best efforts on Stragos' behalf. But it can't threaten Tal Vahrar directly, not to the point that Stragos would feel it a useful step in his intended direction."
Said Jean, "striking, colorful, non-threatening. I'm not entirely sure these concepts blend well with the piratical life."
"Costa," said Drakasha, "you're staring at me very strangely. Do you have an idea, or did I leave you out in the sun for too long today?"
Striking, colourful, and not threatening Tel'Varar directly, Locke whispered. Gods! Captain Drakasha, you would so honour me if you would consent to one humble suggestion.
7. Mount Azar was quiet this morning, the 25th of Orim, and the sky above Salon Corbeau was blue as a river's depths, unmarked by the old volcano's grey smoke. It was another mild winter on the northern brass coast, in a climate more reliable than Varari clockwork.
"New swells coming in," said Zoran, chief dock attendant of the morning watch.
"I don't see any more waves than what we already got."
Jatti, his more junior counterpart, stared earnestly across the harbour.
"Not swells, you idiot. Swells. Gentlefolk. The landed and larded class."
Zoran adjusted his olive-green tabard and brushed it clean, wishing that he didn't have to wear Lady Saljeska's damned felt hat. It made him look taller, but it generated sweat without keeping it out of his eyes. Beyond the natural rock walls of Salon Corbeau's harbour, a stately new brig, a two-master with a dark witchwood hull, had joined the two Lashani Falakas at anchor in the gentle sea. A longboat was coming in from the newcomer, 4 or 5 of the quality rowed by a dozen oarsmen. As the longboat pulled up alongside the dock, Jatti bent down and began uncoiling a rope from one of the dock pilings. When the bow of the boat was secure, Zoran stepped to its side, bowed, and extended his hand to the first young woman to rise from her seat.
"Welcome to Salon Corbeau," he said. "How are you styled, and how must you be announced?"
The short young woman, unusually tanned for someone of her station, smiled prettily as she took Zoran's hand. She wore a forest-green jacket over a matching set of frilled skirts. The colour set her curly, chestnut-coloured hair off rather well. She seemed to be wearing rather less makeup and jewellery than might be expected, however. A poorer relative of whoever owned the ship.
"Forgive me, madam, but I must know whom I'm announcing."
She stepped safely onto the dock, and he released his grip on her hand. To his surprise, she didn't release hers, and in one smooth motion she was up against him with the menacing weight of a blackened steel dagger touching the crook of his thigh. He gasped.
"Heavily armed pirates, party of 98, the woman said. "Scream or fight back, and you're going to be one surprised eunuch."
8.
"Stay calm," said Del Mastro, as Locke led Jean, Striva, Jabril, and Big Conar up onto the dock. "We're all friends here. Just a friendly family coming up for a visit to your lovely little village. City. Thing."
She kept her knife between herself and the older dock attendant, so there was no chance of anyone seeing it from more than a few feet away. Conar took the younger dock attendant, placing one arm around his shoulder as though they knew each other, and muttered something into his ear that made the colour drain from the poor fellow's face. Slowly, carefully, the orchids all made their way onto the dock. At the heart of the group, those wearing layers of fine clothing tried not to make too much noise, laden down as they were with an arsenal of clattering weapons beneath their cloaks and skirts. It had been too much to suppose that the dock attendants wouldn't notice sabres and hatchets in the belts of the rowers.
"Here we are, then," said Locke. "Looks like a nice place," said Jean.
"Looks are most assuredly deceiving. Now we just wait for the captain to get things started."
9. "Excuse me? Excuse me, sir?"
Zamira Drakasha, alone in the orchid's smallest boat, stared up at the bored-looking guard behind the ornamented gunwale of the yacht closest to her ship. That yacht, about 15 yards long, had a single mast and banks of 4 oars per side. Those oars were locked upward now, poised like the wings of a stuffed and mounted bird. Just abaft the mast was a tent-like pavilion with faintly fluttering silk walls. This tent was between the guard and the mainland. The guard peered down at her, squinting. Zamira was wearing a thick, shapeless yellow dress that was almost a robe.
She'd left her hat in her cabin and pulled the bangles and ribbons out of her hair.
"What do you want?"
"My mistress has left me to tend to chores on her ship, while she takes her pleasure ashore," said Zamira. "I have several heavy things to move, and I was wondering if I could beg for your help."
"You want me to come over there and be a mule for you?"
"It would be so kind of you."
"And, what are you prepared to do in exchange?"
"Why, offer my heartfelt thanks to the gods for your goodness," said Zamira. "Or perhaps I could brew you some tea."
"You have a cabin over there?"
"Yes, by the kindness of my mistress."
"A few minutes alone with you and that mouth of yours, and I'd be happy to move your ship for you."
How inappropriate. My mistress will..."
"Who's your mistress, then?"
"The lady in becoming is Rian de la Mastron of Nicora."
"Nicora? Huh? As if anyone would give a shit. Get lost."
The guard turned away, chuckling to himself.
"Ah," said Zamira, "so be it. I know when I'm not wanted."
She reached forward and moved the dun-colored tarpaulin on the bottom of the boat, just ahead of her feet. Beneath it was the heaviest crossbow in the poison orchid's arsenal, carrying a barbed steel bolt the length of her upper arm.
"And I simply do not care."
The guard was no doubt flustered by the sudden emergence, 2 seconds later, of a crossbow quarrel's point from his sternum. Zamira wondered if he had time to speculate on the location of the rest of the bolt before he collapsed, the upper and lower halves of his spine no longer on speaking terms. Zamira pulled the yellow dress up and over her head, then tossed it into the back of the boat. Beneath it she wore her elderglass vest, light tunic and breeches, boots and a pair of slender leather bracers. Her sword belt was at her waist, empty. She reached beneath her rowing bench, pulled out her sabers, and slid them into their scabbards. She rowed her little boat up against the yacht's side and waved to Nazreen, who stood at the orchid's bow. 2 crewfolk climbed over the brig's side and dove into the water. The swimmers were alongside a minute later. Zamira helped them out of the water and sent them forward to man one of the sets of oars. She then pulled the pins to release the yacht's anchor chains. No sense in wasting time hoisting it up. With her 2 sailors rowing and Zamira manning the rudder, it took just a few minutes to shift the yacht behind the poison orchid. Her crew began to come quietly down onto the yacht, armed and armored, looking completely incongruous as they squeezed themselves onto the fragile, scrollwork-covered vessel. Zamira counted 42 before she felt the boat could take no more. Crewfolk were crouched on deck, stuffed into the cabin and manning all the oars. This would do. Nearly 2/3 of her crew on shore to handle the main attack, and the other 1/3 on the orchid to hit the vessels in the harbor. She waved at Utgar, who would be in charge of that last duty. He grinned and left the entry port to begin his final preparations. Zamira's rowers brought the yacht out and around the orchid. They turned to larboard just past her stern and pointed themselves straight toward the beach. Beyond that, the buildings and tiered gardens of the rich little valley could be seen, laid out neat as food before a banquet.
"Who brought the finishing touch?" Zamira asked.
One of her crewmen unfolded a red silk banner and began securing it to the ensign halyard dangling from the yacht's mast.
"Right then."
Zamira knelt at the bow of the yacht and gave her sword belt a habitual adjustment.
"Oars with a will! Put us on that beach!"
As the yacht surged forward across the temporarily calm waters of the bay, Zamira noticed a few small figures atop the nearby cliffs finally taking alarm. 1 or 2 of them ran toward the city. It looked as though they'd arrive about the same time Zamira expected to feel the sand of the beach beneath her boots.
"That's it!" she shouted. "Send up the red and let's have some music!"
As the scarlet banner shot up the halyard and caught the wind, every orchid on the yacht let loose with a wild, wordless howl. Their yells echoed throughout the harbor. The disguised orchids at the dock began seizing weapons. Every visible person on the cliffs was now fleeing for the city, and Zamira's sabers flashed in the sunlight as she drew them for action.
It was the very definition of a beautiful morning. 10.
Was it absolutely necessary to sack Salon Corbeau so thoroughly? Said Stragos.
Locke and Jean were seated in the Archon's office, surrounded by the faint shadowy flutterings of his thousand mechanical insects. It might just have been the shadows of the low-lit room, but it seemed to Locke that the lines on Stragos' face had deepened in the days since he'd last seen him.
It was loads of fun. You have some particular attachment to the place?
Not for my own sake, Lamora. It's just that I had the clear impression that you were going to focus your activities on shipping in the vicinity of Tal Verar.
Salon Corbeau is generally considered to be in the vicinity of...
Is it a ship, Lamora?
There were ships in the harbour.
I have the god's damned numbers here from my agents, said Stragos.
He stabbed at a piece of parchment with two fingers.
2 felucas sunk, 46 yachts, pleasure barges, and smaller craft burned or sunk. 118 slaves stolen, 19 of Countess Salgeska's private guards slain, 16 wounded, the vast majority of Salon Corbeau's residences and guest villas burnt, the gardens all but destroyed. Her replica stadium gutted, miscellaneous damages and losses exceeding 95,000 solari at a first estimate. About the only things you missed were a few shops and Lady Salgeska's residence itself.
Locke smirked. That had been by design. After Salgeska's most important guests had fled to her fortress-like manor and barricaded themselves there with her remaining soldiers, attacking the manor would have been fruitless. The orchids would have been slaughtered beneath the walls. But with their only opposition bottled up atop the valley, Drakasha's crew had been free to run amok for more than an hour, looting and burning the valley at leisure. They'd lost only 4 crewfolk in the attack. As for the shops, well, Locke had specifically requested that the area surrounding the Beaumondaine family business be left alone.
"We didn't have time to hit everything," he said, "and now that Salon Corbeau is more or less ruined, some of those artisans might see fit to settle in Tal Verar. Safer down here, with you and your military around, right?"
"How can you spend your time executing a raid like that so efficiently," said Stragos, "when your efforts toward my primary design are so perfunctory?"
"I object."
"One attack by Orin Ravel. Thank you for that, by the way. The Knight of the Festa, against an Iridani catch hired by a mad eccentric. 2 more reported attacks, both in the vicinity of Salon Corbeau, 1 by Ravel and 1 by the unknown Captain Delamastron. Does Drakasha fear to take credit for her own work?"
"We're trying to create the impression of multiple pirates at work."
"What you are trying is my patience. You have stolen no major cargoes, burned no ships at sea, nor even murdered any crewfolk. You content yourselves with money and portable valuables. You humiliate and frighten your prisoners. You do little more than vandalize their vessels, and then you vanish."
"We can't weigh ourselves down with heavier cargo. We've got a lot of roaming to do."
"It seems to me that you have a fair bit of killing to do," said Stragos. "The city is more bemused now than concerned. I continue to suffer in the public eye for the Ravel affair, but few fear that this spree of hooliganism truly bodes ill for Verari trade. Even the sack of Salon Corbeau has failed to arouse anxiety. Your recent attacks give the impression that you now fear to approach the city again, that these waters remain safe."
Stragos glared before continuing.
"Were I purchasing goods from a tradesman at the moment, I would not be well pleased with their quality."
"The difference, of course," said Locke, "is that when I get fitted for, say, new jackets, I don't poison my tailor until he has the length of the sleeves right."
"My life and fortunes are at stake," said Stragos, rising from his chair, and so are yours, dependent upon your success. I require butchers, not jesters. Take ships within sight of my city walls. Put their crews to the sword. Take their cargo or burn it. The time has come to be serious. That and that alone will stir this city to its foundations. Do not return, he said, emphasizing every word, until you have spilled blood in these waters, until you have become a scourge. So be it, said Locke. Another sip of our antidote. No. If you wish us to work with absolute confidence, you will keep, said Stragos, like pickled eggs in a jar. It has been less than 2 weeks since your last dose. You are in no danger for 6 more. But wait, Archon, Jean interrupted him as he was turning to leave. One thing more. When we came to this city on the night of the festa, we were attacked again. Stragos' eyes narrowed. The same assassins as before? If you mean the same mystery, yes, we think so, said Jean. Some lurked in wait for us at the docks after we visited Requin. If they received a tip-off concerning our presence in the city, they moved damn fast. And the only place we went, added Locke, before visiting the Golden Steps, was here. My people had nothing to do with it, said Stragos. Indeed, this is the first I have heard of the matter. We left 4 dead behind us, said Jean. Unremarkable. The constables found nearly 30 bodies throughout the city after the festa. There are always arguments and robberies to supply them. Stragos sighed. Obviously, this is nothing of my doing, and I have nothing more to tell you on the matter. I presume you'll be returning straight to your ship when you leave?
At speed, said Locke, staying as far from the islands as we can.
The complications of some previous malfeasance have obviously come back to ensnare you, said Stragos. Now leave. No more antidote and no more consultation. You extend your lease on fair health again only once you send panicked merchants to my gates, begging for help because death lurks beyond these harbors. Now go and do your job.
He whirled and left without a further word. A moment later, a squad of eyes marched in through the main door and waited expectantly.
Well, damn, muttered Jean.
11.
"'We'll get the bastard,' said Ezri as they lay together in her cabin that night.
The poison orchid, now calling itself the Mercurial, was treading heavy seas about 20 miles southwest of Tal Varar, and the two of them clung to one another as they rocked back and forth in the hammock.
"'With difficulty,' said Jean. "'He won't see us now until we do some serious work on his behalf. And if we do that, we might push things to the point that he no longer needs us.' We'll get a knife rather than an antidote. Or, if it comes to that, he'll get the knife.
Jean, I don't want to hear that, she said. Don't talk about it.
It's got to be faced, love.
I don't believe it, she said. I don't. There's always a way to attack or a way to escape. That's the way it is out here.
She rolled over on top of him and kissed him.
I told you not to give up, Jean Tannen, and the thing about me is I get my way.
Gods, whispered Jean, how did I ever live before I met you?
Sadly, poorly, miserably, she said. I make everything so much better. It's why the gods put me here. Now quit moping and tell me something pleasant.
Something pleasant?
Yes, slackwit. I've heard that other lovers sometimes tell one another pleasant things when they're alone.
Yes, but with you it's sort of on pain of death, isn't it?
It could be. Let me find a saber.
Ezri, he said with sudden seriousness, look, when this is over, Stragos and all, Leocanto and I might be very rich men, if our other business in Tal Varar goes well.
Not if, she said. When?
All right, he said. When it does. You really could come with us. Leo and I spoke about it a bit. You don't have to choose one life or another, Esri. You can just sort of go on leave for a bit. We all could.
What do you mean?
We could get a yacht, said Jean. In Velvarazzo, there's this place, the private marina, where all the swells keep their boats and barges. They usually have a few for sale, if you've got a few hundred solari on hand, which we intend to. We have to go to Velvarazzo anyway to sort of finish our business. We could have a boat fitted out in a couple of days, and then just poke around a bit, drift, enjoy ourselves, pretend to be useless gentlefolk for a while.
And come back to all this later, you mean?
Whenever you wanted, said Jean. Have it as you like. You always get your way, don't you?
Live on a yacht for a while with you and Leo Canto, she said. No offence, Jean. You're passable for a landsman, but by his own admission, Leo Canto couldn't con a shoe across a puddle of piss.
What do you think we'd be bringing you along for, hm?
Well, I would have imagined that this had something to do with it, she said, moving her hands strategically to a more interesting location.
Ah, he said, and so it does. But you could sort of be honorary captain, too.
Can I name the boat?
As if you'd let anyone else do it.
All right, she whispered. If that's the plan, that's the plan. We'll do it.
You really mean...
Hell, she said. With just the swag we pulled from Salon Corbeau, everyone on this crew can stay drunk for months when we get back to the Ghost Winds. Zamira won't miss me for a while. They kissed. Half a year. They kissed again. Year or two, maybe.
Always a way to attack, Jean mused between kisses. Always a way to escape.
Of course, she whispered. Hold fast, and sooner or later you'll always find what you're after.
12. Jafrim Rodanov paced the quarterdeck of the Dread Sovereign in the silvery orange light of earliest morning. They were bound north by west with the wind on the starboard quarter, about 40 miles southwest of Tal Varar. The seas were running at 5 or 6 feet. Tal Varar. Half a day's sailing to the city they'd avoided like a colony of slipskinners these past 7 years, to the home of a navy that could crush even his powerful sovereign if roused to anger. There was no genuine freedom in these waters, only a vague illusion. Fat merchant ships he could never touch, a rich city he could never sack. Yet he could live with that. It was grand, provided only that the freedom and the plunder of the southern seas could remain.
"Captain," said Idrena, appearing on deck with a chipped clay mug of her usual brandy-laced morning tea in one hand, "I don't mean to ruin a fine new morning."
"You wouldn't be my first if I needed my ass kissed more than I needed my ship sailed."
"A week out here without a lead, Captain."
"We've seen 2 dozen sails of merchants, luggers, and pleasure galleys just these past 2 days," said Rodanov, "and we have yet to see a naval ensign. There's still time to find her."
"No quarrel with that logic, Captain. It's the finding her that's..."
"A royal pain in the ass, I know."
"It's not as though she'll be roaming around announcing herself as Zamira Drakasha of the Poison Orchid," said Idrena, taking a sip of her tea. "Well met, we're infamous shipwreckers from the Ghost Winds. Mind if we pull alongside for a visit?"
"She can claim whatever name she likes," said Rodanov. "Paint whatever she wants on her stern, mess with her sail plan until she looks like a constipated zebek. But she's only got one hull, dark witchwood hull, and we've been seeing it for years."
"All hulls are dark until you get awful close, Captain."
"Idrena, if I had a better notion, believe me, we'd be pursuing it." He yawned and stretched, feeling the heavy muscles in his arms flex pleasantly.
Only word we've got is a few ships getting hit, and now Salon Corbeau. She's circling out there somewhere, keeping west. It's what I do, more sea room.
Aye, said Idrena. Such a very great deal of sea room.
Idrena, he said softly, I've come a long way to break an oath and kill a friend. I'll go as far as it takes, and I'll haunt her wake as long as it takes. We'll quarter this sea until one of us finds the other.
Or the crew decides they've had...
It's a good long haul till we cross that line. In the meantime, double all our top-eyes by night. Triple them by day. We'll put half the fucking crew up the masts if we have to. New sail ahoy! Called a voice from atop the foremast. The cry was passed back down the deck, and Rodanov ran forward, unable to restrain himself. They'd heard the cry 50 times that week if they'd heard it once, but each time might be the time. "Where away?" 3 points off the starboard bow! Idrena, Rodanov shouted, set more canvas, straight for the sighting. Helm, bring us about north-northeast on the starboard tack. Whatever the sighting was, the dread sovereign was at home in wind and waters like this. Her size and weight allowed her to crash through waves that would steal speed from lighter vessels. They would close with the sighting very soon. Still, the minutes passed interminably. They came about to their new course, seizing the power of the wind now blowing from just abaft their starboard beam. Rodanov prowled the forecastle, waiting.
"Captain Rodanov! She's a two-master, sir! Say again, two masts!"
"Very good," he shouted. "Idrena, first mate to the forecastle." She was there in a minute, pale blonde hair fluttering in the breeze. She tossed back the last of her morning tea as she arrived. "Take my best glass to the foretop," he said. "Tell me, as soon as you know anything."
"Aye," she said. "At least it's something to do."
The morning progressed with torturous slowness, but at least the sky was cloudless. Good conditions for spotting. The sun grew higher and brighter until...
"Captain!" hollered Idrena. "Witchwood Hull! That's a two-masted brig with a Witchwood Hull!"
He couldn't stand waiting passively any more. "I'm coming up myself!" he shouted. Laboriously, he crawled up the foremast shrouds to the observation platform at the maintop, a place he'd left to smaller, younger sailors for many years. Idrena was perched there, along with a crewman who shuffled aside to make room for him on the platform. Rodanov took the glass and peered at the ship on the horizon, stared at it until not even the most cautious part of himself would let him deny it. "It's her," he said. "She's done something fancy to her sails, but that's the Orchid."
"What now?"
"Set every scrap of canvas we can bear," he said. "Steal as much of this ocean from her as we can before she recognizes us."
"Do you want to try and bring her up with signals? Offer parley, then jump her?"
"Let us speak behind our hands, lest our lips be read as the book of our designs," he said.
"More of your poetry?"
"Verse, not poetry, and no. She'll recognize us sooner or later, and when she does, she'll know exactly what our business is." He passed the glass back to Idrena, and prepared to go back down the shrouds. "Straight on for her, cloaks off and weapons free. We can give her that much for the last fight she'll ever have."
Chapter 15. Between Brethren. 1.
"Does Jerome know that you're asking me to do this?"
"No."
Locke stood beside Drakasha at the taffrail, huddled close to her so they could converse privately. It was the 7th hour of the morning, more or less, and the sun was ascending into a cloudless bowl of blue sky. The wind was from the east, a touch abaft their starboard beam, and the waves were getting rowdy.
"And you feel that..."
"Yes, I do feel that I can speak for both of us,"
said Locke. "There's no other choice. We won't see Stragos again unless you do as he asks. And to be frank, if you do as he asks, I think our usefulness ends. We'll have one more chance at physical access to him. It's time to show this fucker how we used to do things in Camor."
"I thought you specialized in dishonest finesse."
"I also do a brisk trade in putting knives to people's throats and shouting at them," said Locke. "But if you request another meeting after we sink a few ships for him, don't you think he'll be prepared for treachery? Especially in a palace crowded with soldiers?" "All I have to do is get close to him," said Locke. "I'm not going to pretend I could fight my way through a wall of guards, but from 6 inches with a good stiletto, I'm the hand of Azaguia herself."
"Hold him hostage, then?"
"Simple, direct, hopefully effective. If I can't trick an antidote out of him or cut a deal with his apothecary, maybe I can frighten him half to death."
"And you honestly believe you've thought this through?"
"Captain Drakasha, I could barely sleep for pondering it. Why do you think I wandered back here to find you?"
"Captain!"
The mainmast watch was hailing the deck.
"Got action behind us!"
"What do you mean?"
"Sail maybe 3 points off the larboard quarter at the horizon. Just came around real sudden. Went from sort of westerly to pointed right at us."
"Good eyes," said Drakasha. "Keep me informed. Utgar."
"Aye, Captain."
"Double the watch on each mast. On deck there. Make ready for a course change. Stand by tacks and braces. Wait for my word."
"Real trouble, Captain?"
"Probably not," said Drakasha. "Even if Stragos had changed his mind since yesterday and decided to hunt us down now, a Varari warship wouldn't be coming from that direction."
"Hopefully."
"Aye. So what we do is we change our own heading, nice and slow. If their course change was innocent, they'll sail merrily past." She cleared her throat. "Helm, come round northwest by north, smartly. Utgar, get the yards braced for a wind on the starboard quarter."
"Aye, Captain."
The poison orchid slowly heeled even farther to larboard, until she was headed almost due northwest. The stiff breeze now blew across the quarterdeck, nearly into Locke's face. To the south he fancied that he could see tiny sails. From the deck the vessel was still hull down. A few minutes later came the shout,
"Captain! She's come 5 or 6 points to her larboard! She's for us again!"
"We're off her starboard bow," said Drakasha. "She's trying to close with us. But that doesn't make sense." She snapped her fingers. "Wait! Might be a bounty privateer."
"How could they know it's us?"
"Probably got a description of the orchid from the crew of that ketch you visited. Look, we could only hope to disguise my girl for so long. These lovely witchwood planks of hers are too distinctive."
"So, how much of a problem is this?"
"Depends on who's got the speed. If she's a bounty privateer, that's a profitless fight. She'll be carrying dangerous folk and no swag. So if we're the faster, I mean to show her our ass and wave farewell."
"And if not?"
"A profitless fight."
"Captain!"
hollered one of the top eyes.
"She's a three-master!"
"This just gets better and better," said Drakasha. "Go wake up Ezri and Jerome for me."
2.
"Bad luck," said Del Mastro. "Bad damned luck."
"Only for them, if I have my way," said Zamira. The captain and her lieutenant stood at the taffrail, staring at the faint square of white that marked their pursuer's position on the horizon. Locke waited with Jean a few steps away at the starboard rail. Drakasha had nudged the ship a few points south, so that they were travelling west-northwest with the wind fine on the starboard quarter, what she claimed was the orchid's best point of sail. Locke knew this was something of a risk. If their opponent was the faster, they could lay an intercepting course that would bring them up much sooner than a stern chase. The trouble was that such a chase to the north could not last. Unlimited sea room existed only to their west.
"'I'm not sure we're gaining any ground, Captain,' said Del Mastro after a few minutes of silence. "'Nor I. Damn this jumpy sea. If she's a three-master, she may have the weight to carve a better speed out of it.'
"'Captain!'
The cry from up the mainmast was even more urgent than usual.
"'Captain, she's not falling away! And, Captain, begging pardon, but you might want to come and see this for yourself!'
"'See what?'
"'If I ain't mad, I've seen that ship before!'
shouted the watchwoman.
"'I'd swear it! I'd appreciate another set of eyes!'
"'I'll take a look,' said Del Mastro. "'Mind if I fetch up your favourite glass?' "'Drop it, and I'll give your cabin over to Paolo and Cosetta.' Locke watched as Del Mastro went up the mainmast a few minutes later, armed with Zamira's pride and joy, a masterpiece of Ferrari optics bound in alchemically treated leather. It was a few minutes more before her shout fell to the deck.
"'Captain! That's the Dread Sovereign!'
"'What?
Del, are you absolutely sure?' "'Seen her often enough, haven't I?'
"'I'm coming up myself!' Locke exchanged a stare with Jean as Zamira leapt into the mainmast shrouds. A buzz of muttering and swearing had arisen among the crewfolk on deck. About a dozen abandoned their chores and headed aft, craning their necks for a glimpse of the sail in the south. They cleared away in alarm when Dracasha and Del Mastro returned to the quarterdeck, looking grim.
"'So it's him?' said Locke.
"'It is,' said Dracasha, "'and if he's been looking for us for any length of time, "'it means he sailed not all that long after we did.'
"'So he could be carrying a message or something, right?'
"'No.' Dracasha removed her hat and ran her other hand through her braids, almost nervously. "'He opposed this plan more than anyone else on the Council of Captains.' He didn't sail as long and as far as we did to risk his ship within spitting distance of Tal Varrar to deliver any message.
I'm afraid we'll need to postpone our previous conversation, Ravel. The point is moot until we're sure this ship will still be floating at the end of the day.
3. Locke stared out across the white caps of the Dread Sovereign, now well over the horizon, fixed on them like a needle drawn toward a lodestone. It was the 10th hour of the morning, and Rodanov's progress at their expense was obvious. Zamira slammed her glass shut and whirled away from the taffrail, where she'd been studying the same phenomenon.
"'Captain,' said Del Mastro, "'there must be something, if we can just keep him off until nightfall.'
"'Then we'd have options, aye. But only a straight stern chase could buy us that much time.' And if we fly north, we'll find the coast long before dusk. Not to mention the fact that she's fresh careened and we're past due. The plain truth is, we've already lost this race.
Dracasha and Del Mastro said nothing to each other for several moments, until Del Mastro cleared her throat.
I'll start getting things ready, shall I?
You'd better. Let the Red Watch keep sleeping as long as you can, if any of them are still asleep.
Del Mastro nodded, grabbed Jean by the tunic sleeve, and pulled him with her toward the main deck cargo hatch.
"'You mean to fight?' said Locke.
"'I have no choice but to fight, and neither do you, if you want to live to see dinner. Rodanov has nearly twice our numbers. You understand what a mess we're looking at.'
"'And it's all for my sake, more or less. I'm sorry, Captain.
"'Avast bullshit, Ravel.' I won't second-guess my decision to help you, so no one else gets to either. This is Stragos doing, not yours. One way or another, his plans would have put us in a tight spot.
Thank you for that, Captain Dracasha. Now, I know we've had our talk concerning the real extent of my skills in battle, but most of the crew probably still thinks I'm some sort of man-killer. I guess I'm saying...
You want a spot in the thick of it?
"'Yes.
Thought you might ask. I already have a place for you,' she said. "'Don't think you'll have it easy.'
She stepped away for a moment and shouted forward. "'Utgar?'
"'Aye, Captain!'
"'Fetch the deep-sea lead and give me a cast.'
Locke raised his eyebrows by way of a question, and she said,
Need to know how much water we have beneath our feet. Then I'll know about how long it'll take the anchor to drop.
Why would you want to drop an anchor?
On that matter, you'll just have to wait to be amazed, along with Radanov, hopefully, but that would be asking a great deal.
Captain!
Utgar yelled several minutes later.
Got about 90 fathoms under us!
Right, she said. Ravel, I know you're off watch right now, but you were witless enough to wander back here and call attention to yourself. Grab a couple of blues and bring up some ale casks from down below. Try to stay quiet for the sake of the reds still sleeping. I'll call all hands in about an hour, and it's never wise to send people into a tussle like this with their throats too dry.
I'll be happy to do that, Captain. About an hour, then? When do you think we'll be?
I mean to bring the fight before noon. Only one way to win when you're being chased by someone bigger and tougher than you are. Turn straight around, punch their teeth out, and hope the gods are fond of you. 4.
All hands! Shouted Ezri one last time. All hands at the waist! Idlers and lazy motherfuckers on deck! If you have watchmates still below, haul 'em up yourselves!
Jean stood at the front of the crowd amidships, waiting for Drakasha to say her piece. She stood at the rail with Ezri, Nazreen, Utgar, Mumchance, Gwillem, and Tregan behind her. The scholar looked deeply annoyed that something as trivial as a murderous ship-to-ship fight could justify disrupting her usual habits.
"Listen well!" shouted Drakasha. "The ship bearing down on us is the Dread Sovereign. Captain Radanov has taken exception to our business in these waters, and he's come a long way to give us a fight."
"We can't fight that many people!" shouted someone in the crowd.
"It's not as though we have a choice. They're closing to board now, whether we like it or not," said Drakasha.
"But what if it's just you he's after?"
A crewman Jean didn't recognize spoke up. To give him credit, he too was standing at the front of the crowd, right where Drakasha and all of her officers could see him.
"We give you to him. We save ourselves a hell of a fight! This isn't a navy, and I got the right to be as fond of my life as..."
Jabril pushed through the crowd behind the man and punched him in the small of the back. The man fell writhing to the deck.
"We don't know that it's just Drakasha he wants," Jabril shouted. "Me? I ain't waiting at the rail with my britches down for someone to kiss my cock. Most of you know as well as I. If captain fights captain, it ain't convenient to let two sides of the story get back to Port Prodigal."
"Hold, Jabril," said Zamira. She hurried down the quarterdeck stairs, stepped over to the would-be pragmatist, and helped him sit up. She then stood before her assembled crew, within reach of the first row. "Bazarin here is right about one thing. This isn't a navy, so you do have the right to be fond of your own lives. I'm not your goddamned empress. Anyone wants to try handing me over to Radanov, I'm right here. Now is your chance."
When nobody stepped forward from the crowd, Drakasha heaved Bazarin to his feet and looked him straight in the eyes.
"Now you can have the smallest boat," she said. "You and anyone else who wants to help you take it. Or you can stay."
"Oh, hell," he said, groaning. "I'm sorry, Captain. I guess I'd rather live as a coward than die a fool."
"Oskal," said Drakasha, "when we're done here, get a party together and hoist out the small boat, on the quick. Anyone else wants off with Bazarin, that's what I'm giving you. If Radanov wins, take your chances. If I win, understand that we're at least 50 miles from land and you're not coming back aboard." The man nodded, and that was that. Drakasha released him, and he stumbled into the crowd, holding his back and ignoring the glares of those around him.
"Heed this now!" shouted Drakasha. "The sea isn't our friend today. That son of a bitch has more bite in the water than we do. A chase in any direction can't buy us more than a few hours. If we're going to settle this at kissing distance, I intend to set the terms of the courtship."
We need to kill two for one just to have any of us left standing. So obviously we need to do better even than that. If we lock up with him so that one of our sides is against his bow, we can crowd in all around his boarding point and outnumber him at the only place it matters. That big fat crew of his won't mean a damn thing if he has to feed it piece by piece right through our teeth. So, at the waist, I'll put you in ranks, like the old Ferin Throne legions. Swords and shields up front, spears and halberds behind. Don't take your sweet time. If you can't kill someone, knock them into the water. Just get them out of the damn fight. Del will choose our 10 best archers and send you aloft to do the obvious. 5 per mast. I wish I could send more, but we're going to need every blade on deck we can get. Ravel, Valora, I'm going to give you a few crew folk to form our flying company. Your job is the Sovereign's boats. They'll try and board us from all points of the compass once we're engaged at the waist. So you go wherever they go. One person on deck can keep 5 in a boat, provided you act with haste. Nazreen, you'll choose a party of 3 and stand by at the starboard anchor for my command. Once it's given, you'll guard the bow against boats and free Ravel's party to fight elsewhere. Utgar, you're with me to load crossbows. Now, there's ale at the forecastle, and I want to see the cask dry before we do this. Drink up, find your armor. If you've got mail or leathers you've been saving, pile it on. I don't care how much you sweat, you'll never need it again like you'll need it today.
Drakasha dismissed the crew by turning away from them and striding back up the quarterdeck stairs. Pandemonium erupted amidships. Suddenly crew folk were shoving past one another in all directions, some going for their armor and weapons, others headed for what might be their last drink in life. Ezri vaulted the quarterdeck railing and shouted as she strode forward into the chaos.
"Fire watches, set double sand buckets! Rig the larboard razor net and hoist it high! Jerome, get your lazy ass up on the quarterdeck! Form up the flying company there!"
Jean waved and followed Drakasha up to the stern of the ship, where Utgar waited, looking nervous. Tregan was just descending the companionway stairs, muttering something about bulk rates. Suddenly, a low, dark shape shot up the companionway and ran for Drakasha. She looked down in response to a sudden tug on her breeches and found Paolo clutching at her, unself-consciously.
"Mommy, the noise!"
Zamira smiled and swept him up off the deck, cradling him against the lapels of her jacket. She turned into the wind and let it push her hair out of her face. Jean could see that Paolo's eyes were on the dread sovereign as it heaved and swayed beneath the cloudless sky, implacably clawing across the distance between them.
"Paolo, love, Mommy needs you to help her hide you and your sister in the rope locker on the all-up deck, all right?"
The little boy nodded, and Zamira kissed him on the forehead, burying her nose in his tangle of short dark curls with her eyes closed.
"Oh, good," she said a moment later, "because after that, Mommy needs to fetch her armor and her sabers, and then she needs to go board that lying motherfucker's ship and sink it like a stone."
5. Jafrim Rodanov was at the bow of his ship, the poison orchid steady in the center of his glass, when she suddenly whirled to larboard and pointed herself at him like an arrow. Her mainsails shivered and began to vanish as Drakasha's crew hauled them up for battle.
"Ah," he said, "there we go, Zamira, doing the only sensible thing at last."
Rodanov had dressed for a fight, as usual, in a leather coat reinforced with mail inset at the back and the lapels. The nicks and creases in the battered old thing were always a comfort to him, a reminder that people had been trying and failing to kill him for years. On his hands he wore his favored segmented blackened steel gauntlets. In the confusion of a close melee, they could catch blades and break skulls. For the less personal work of actually forcing his way aboard the Orchid, he leaned on a waist-high, iron-studded club. He folded his glass carefully and slipped it into a pocket, resolving to return it to the binnacle before the fight began. Not like the last time.
"Orders, Captain?"
Idrena waited on the forecastle stairs, her own curved sword sheathed on her back, with the majority of his crew ready behind her.
"She's for us," boomed Rodanov. "I know this doesn't come easy, but Drakasha's raiding in Ferrari waters. She'll call down hell on the life we all enjoy, unless we stop her now. Form up to starboard as we planned. Shields up front, crossbows behind. Remember, one volley, then throw 'em down and pull steel. Boat crews over the starboard side once we're locked with the Orchid. Grapples ready at the waist and bow. Helm, you have your orders. Make it perfect or pray you die in the fight. This day will be red. Drakasha is a foe to be reckoned with. But what are we over all the winds and waters of the sea of brass?
Sovereign,
the crew shouted as one.
Who are we, never boarded and never beaten?
Sovereign!
What do our enemies scream when they speak the name of their doom at the judgment of the gods?
Sovereign!
We are!
He waved his club above his head.
And we have some surprises for Zamira Drakasha. Bring the cages forward!
Three teams of six sailors apiece brought canvas-covered cages to the forecastle deck. These cages had wooden carrying handles set well beyond their steel mesh sides. They were about 6 feet long and half as wide and high.
Nothing to eat since yesterday, right?
No, said Idrena.
Good.
Rodanov double-checked the sections of the starboard rail his carpenter had weakened, so one good shove would knock them over for about a 10-foot length. A blemish on his beloved sovereign, but one that could be fixed easily enough later.
Set them down over here, and kick the cages. Let's get them riled up.
6. The two ships crashed through the waves toward each other, and for a second time Loch Lamora found himself about to get involved rather intimately in a battle at sea.
Steady, mum,
called Drakasha, who stood peering out over the larboard quarterdeck rail. Locke and Jean waited nearby, armed with hatchets and sabres. Jean also had a pair of leather bracers liberated from the property of Bazarin, who was nowhere to be seen since he alone had gone over the side with the small boat. My boat, Locke thought, somewhat bitterly. For their flying company, Locke and Jean had Malakasti, Jabril, and Striva, as well as Gwillem. All save the latter had shields and spears. The timid-looking quartermaster wore a leather apron stuffed with heavy lead bullets for the sling he carried in his left hand. Most of the crew waited amidships, ranked as Drakasha had ordered. Those with large shields and stabbing swords up front, those with pole arms in back. The mainsails were drawn up, fire buckets were set out, the larboard entry port was protected by what Del Mastro had called a skinner net, and the poison orchid was rushing to the dread sovereign's embrace like a long-separated lover. Del Mastro appeared out of the mess at the waist. She looked much as she had the first time Locke had ever seen her, with her leather armor on and her hair pulled back for action. Paying no heed to the weapons they were carrying at their belts, she leapt onto Jean, wrapping her arms and legs around him. He put his arms behind her back and they kissed until Locke chuckled out loud. Not the sort of thing one saw just before most battles, he imagined.
"This day is ours," she said, when they parted at last.
"Try not to kill everyone over there before I even get involved, right?"
Jean grinned down at her, and she handed him something in a small silk bag.
"What's this?"
"Lock of my hair," she said. "Meant to give it to you days ago, but we got busy with all the raiding. You know, piracy. Hectic life."
"Thank you, love," he said.
"Now, if you find yourself in trouble wherever you go, you can hold up that little bag to whoever's bothering you, and you can say, 'You have no idea who you're fucking with. I'm under the protection of the lady who gave me this object of her favor.'"
"And that's supposed to make them stop?"
"Shit, no. That's just to confuse them. Then you kill them while they're standing there looking at you funny."
They hugged again, and Drakasha cleared her throat.
Del, if it's not too much trouble, we're planning to attack that ship just ahead of us, so could you...
Oh, yeah, the fight of our lives. I guess I could help you out for a few minutes, Captain.
Luck, Del.
Luck, Zamira.
Captain, said Mumchance. Now!
Nazreen! Drakasha bellowed at the top of her considerable voice. Starboard anchor away!
Sound collision, called Del Mastro a moment later. All hands brace yourselves, up aloft, grab a mast, grab a line.
Someone began to ring the foremast bell frantically. The two ships were closing with astonishing speed. Locke and Jean crouched on the larboard quarterdeck stairs, clinging tight to the inner rail. Locke glanced over at Drakasha and saw that she was counting something, mouthing each number intently to herself. Curious, he tried to puzzle them out and concluded she wasn't counting in Therin.
"Captain," said Mumchance, calm as someone ordering coffee. "Other ship?"
"Helm hard a larboard!" Drakasha shouted. Mumchance and his mate began manhandling the ship's wheel to the left. Suddenly there was a creak and a snapping noise from the bow. The ship shuddered end to end and was jerked to starboard as though caught in the teeth of a gale. Locke felt his stomach protesting and clung to the rail with all of his strength.
"Anchor party!" yelled Drakasha. "Cut the cable!"
Locke had an excellent view of the dread sovereign rushing down on them, scarcely 100 yards away. He gasped to think of that heavy ship's bowsprit plunging like a spear into the Orchid or her masked crewfolk, but even as he watched, the three-master heeled over to larboard, making a turn of her own. Rodanoff avoided a head-on collision, and Locke had to guess that was intentional. While it might have done serious damage to the Orchid, it would have locked his ship precisely where Zamira could best resist his boarders, and possibly sunk both ships sooner or later. What happened was spectacular enough. The sea creamed white between the two vessels, and Locke heard the protesting waves hissing like steam baking furiously from hot coals. There was no way for the Sovereign or the Orchid to shed all their forward momentum, but they slid into each other along their sides with a rolling cushion of water between them. The whole world seemed to shake as they met. Timbers creaked, masts shuddered, and high overhead an Orchid was pitched from her position. She struck the Sovereign's deck, becoming the first casualty of the battle.
"Spanker! Spanker!"
Zamira cried, and everyone on the quarterdeck looked up in unison as the Orchid's spanker sail was unfurled in the most unseamanlike fashion possible by the small crew detailed to it. Fluttering down to full extension, it was braced in place with desperate speed. Ordinarily, the fore and aft sail would never have been placed side on to a wind, but in this case the stiff breeze from the east pushed against it by intention, heaving the Orchid's stern away from contact with the dread sovereign. Mumchance hauled his wheel to starboard now, trying to help the process along. There was a series of screams and snapping noises from forward. The dread sovereign's bowsprit was destroying or fouling much of the forward rigging, but Drakasha's plan seemed to be working. That bowsprit hadn't punched a hole in the hull, and now Radanov's starboard bow was the only part of his ship in contact with Drakasha's larboard side. From high above, Locke thought, the gods might have seen the two ships as drunken fencers, their bowsprits crossed but doing relatively little harm as they waved about. Unseen things clawed the air with a snake-like hiss, and Locke realized that arrows were raining around him. The fight had well and truly begun.
7. "Clever Syresti bitch," muttered Rodanoff as he crawled back to his feet after the collision. Drakasha was using her spanker for leverage to prevent full broadside-to-broadside contact. So be it. He had his own advantages ready to play.
"Let 'em loose!" he shouted.
A crewman standing well back from the rear of the three cages, with shield-bearers flanking him, pulled the rope that released their doors. These were set just inches back from the collapsible section of the rail, which had been conveniently knocked clean away when the ships met. A trio of adult Valcona, starving, shaken up, and pissed off beyond all measure, exploded from their confinement, shrieking like the vengeful undead.
The first thing they laid eyes on was the group of orchids lining up across the way. Though heavily armed and armored, Zamira's people had no doubt expected to repel human boarders first. The three attack birds launched themselves through the air and landed amidst shields and polearms, laying about with their beaks and their dagger-sized claws. Orchids screamed, shoved against one another, and caused utter chaos in their desperate struggle to either swing at or flee from the ferocious beasts. Rodanov grinned fiercely. They'd been worth it, even though they'd cost too much in Prodigal, even though they'd stunk up the hold, even though they'd be dead soon enough. Every orchid they mutilated was one less for his people to face, and it was always impossible to put a price on making your enemy shit their britches.
"Away, boats!" he yelled. "Sovereigns, on me!"
8. The screams from forward were more than human. Locke scrambled up the quarterdeck stairs on his hands and knees, straining to see what was going on. Brown shapes were flailing about within the packed masses of Zamira's legions along the larboard side. What the hell was that? Drakasha herself dashed past, twin sabers out, running for the point of greatest chaos. Several sailors aboard Rodanov's ship hurled grappling hooks across the gap between the vessels. A team of Drakasha's crewfolk, waiting for this, hurried to the larboard rail to sever the grappling lines with hatchets. One of them toppled with an arrow in his throat. The rest made short work of every line Locke could see. A sharp, flat thwack told of an arrow landing nearby. Jean grabbed him by his tunic collar and hauled him all the way onto the quarterdeck. His flying company was crouched behind their small shields. Malakasti was using hers to cover Mumchance as well.